Hi, this is Kevin Barrett. You know, I've been on a lot of alternative radio networks on my day. I started out on Republic Broadcasting, that's RBN, with John Stadtmiller. Then I was on GCN with Ted Anderson and Alex Jones. Moved on to Danny Romero's networks, We the People, and American Freedom Radio. You know, all of those networks broke up my shows with commercials. And I got kind of tired of that, so now I'm doing strictly non-commercial radio. And the only way I can do that is if listeners like you go to truthjihad.com and either subscribe for $3.95 per month, which is just about the cost of a decent cup of coffee these days. For only $3.95 a month, you can get early access to all of my shows. Or if you prefer, you can leave a one-time donation or gift by way of the PayPal button at truthjihad.com. So please go to truthjihad.com and do what you can so I don't have to put out commercials anymore. Like this. Howdy, partner. My name is Hardy Har 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 Har. My first name is Hardy. My middle name is Har Har. And my last name is Har Har, too. Now, I'm here to tell you about a brand new product that's going to help you survive the coming calamities. It's Hardy Har 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 Special 38-Karat Gold Aerosol Spray. It's an aerosol spray made out of pure gold. Comes in 8-ounce, 12-ounce, and 16-ounce canisters. Just depress the little red nozzle on the tip of the canister and... psst! You got gold! When the BS finally hits the blade, you better have a whole bunch of these little beauties stashed in your basement. Just think about all the ways they're going to help you survive. When the dollar finally collapses and all those greenbacks in your pocket won't be worth nothing unless you spray them with gold. Psst! Now you got a gold greenback. And gold's been holding on to its value since the bad old days of Babylon. Sounds great, don't it? Well, that ain't all. You can also use Hardy Har 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 Har's 38-karat gold aerosol spray to remove radiation from the atmosphere. Psst! Your bedroom is now free from Fukushima fallout. And it works in the kitchen and the living room, too. And that ain't all. Just step outside. Ooh, look at that sky full of chemtrails. Well, with just one upward burst from Hardy Har 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 Har's 38-karat gold aerosol spray, psst, and all those toxic nanoparticles of aluminum, barium, and strontium are magically removed from the atmosphere above you. And if you catch the bird flu or Ebola or any of those manufactured New World Order diseases, you can use Hardy Har 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 Har's 38-karat gold aerosol spray as a nasal spray, an underarm deodorant spray, a remedy for athlete's foot or jock itch, or even a suppository. And in the increasingly likely event of another big false flag, just squirt a quick burst of Hardy Har 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 Har's 38-karat aerosol gold spray into the eyes of your friends, family, and neighbors, and watch those squeezed shut eyes open wide. So step right up, folks, and get your Hardy Har 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 Har's 38-karat aerosol gold spray, available wherever dubious products advertised on alternative radio are sold. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. Kevin Barrett, waging the Truth Jihad. 4 or 5 great guests every week, telling you all sorts of hard truths that you never are going to hear in the mainstream. And the number one case that we deal with here is, of course, the coup d'etat on September 11th, 2001, a murderous crime that still hasn't been properly investigated and prosecuted. It's an event that changed the world. In retrospect, it will probably be the biggest event of the 21st century. And a few people out there are still working hard to get some truth and justice around this. And one of them is today's guest, Matt Campbell. Matt Campbell lost his brother Jeff in the World Trade Towers on September 11, 2001, and he's not letting it go. He's working on getting an actual inquiry in the High Court over in the UK, and maybe from the bad guy's perspective, is getting dangerously close to actually having something happen there. We have some news to break about that, so let's go to Matt Campbell. How are you, Matt?
Yeah, I'm fine. How are you, Kevin?
I'm okay. It's good to be back with you, and I'm very much in admiration of what you're doing. It takes a lot of courage, and you're also doing it strategically and intelligently, and it's great how you got that favorable media coverage in The Express. That's one of the best stories I've ever seen on a 9/11 topic. The Express basically admitted or at least took the line that you were basically right, that there just isn't enough hard evidence to support the official version of 9/11.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to get that article in the Sunday Express. I am forever emailing people, whether it be in the press or authority. And it was just one of many emails that I'd sent promoting a play called ISIS, which was on in London. Not ISIS, as we might know, or what the press tells us, but all to do with infiltration and surveillance and stuff like that, which basically must have caught the eye of one of the editors at one of the papers, the Sunday Express. And yeah, he got back to me and wanted to know more about the play, but in particular, my efforts to reopen my brother's inquest. So I was kind of surprised it went into the press. I mean, it threw in its usual throwaway lines of the official story, which, you know, I was challenging that there isn't any evidence supporting the official story. But yeah, it was better than most, certainly tabloid newspaper articles I've seen on 9/11 for a while.
Right. Well, I think the overall effect of this story on somebody who's not part of the choir would be favorable for the 9/11 truth cause. I mean, they would sympathize with you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he kept to the facts, certainly from my perspective, and I don't think he really changed what I was trying to say, which is, you know, from my perspective as a family member, without even going into any alternative counter theories to what the government's presented to us, it's just that lack of fundamental evidence, particularly towards the perpetrators who, you know, according to the authorities and the media, it's all wrapped up. It's the 19 chaps armed with box cutters. And, you know, I think that certainly we have a right, and certainly my brother deserves to have, you know, at least some basic fundamental evidence supporting the official narrative, which just it hasn't been forthcoming. And I have tried for many years to try and get hold of such evidence from the authorities with no luck. So, I mean, it was good that the article kind of stuck mainly to that, you know, and made it very plain on my stance that, you know, in the absence of any evidence, I do not believe the official narrative. And my intention is to get my brother's inquest reopened to expose that absence of evidence, but also the lies of government.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you're taking this approach. In the 9/11 truth movement, there's been a very heavy focus on the evidence for controlled demolition at the Trade Center, and not so much on what I think is an equally obvious smoking gun, which is, as you say, the lack of evidence against the 19 guys that they blame. You know, there's all kinds of bizarre sort of evidence or statements from FBI officials at some point saying, well, they're not sure they'll ever really know for sure who were the 19 guys. Maybe it was identity theft. And there's lots of evidence for identity theft. And there's no evidence whatsoever that these guys were even on the planes. As Elias Davidson has pointed out, they should have immediately filed all of the evidence, the ticket stubs, the authenticated passenger lists, the video surveillance, and the testimony from the people who would have ticketed and checked in these 19 guys. And yet not a shred of any of that is available. And if the government, the U.S. government, says that these 19 guys committed this incredible crime, and, you know, that's the countries that the 19 people came from, their families, and of course the world, deserve to see the evidence that they did it, and we've never been showed that.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible situation, really. You know, forget the fact it was the mass murder of 3,000 people. It's, you know, it's there's been at least one murder committed, and some people have been blamed for it, but nothing's been put forward, which is something I'm struggling to get the authorities in this country to get their head around, because they all trot out the line, you know, we rely on the 9/11 Commission report, and it's very hard to get them to go any further than that.
And that's very strange. A decade after David Ray Griffin published the 9/11 Commission report, Omissions and Distortions, and Philip Shannon of the New York Times published his book showing that Zelikow,
the public myth specialist who wrote the whole report and chapter by chapter outline even before it convened, was totally corrupt and in connection with Karl Rove and the Bush administration the whole time he was crafting the false narrative. It's been completely discredited to anyone who's paying attention, and yet they keep saying, well, we just believe this report. It's bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't even believe half the people that I'm in contact with have actually read it anyway. It's just like a safe line. It's like whatever people used to say in the 80s about hiring someone from IBM because you never got fired for taking on IBM as a consultant or something. And it's a safe option for them.
Right.
I'm hoping this is going to change. I mean, for me, you know, there are other legal paths I can take, but the inquest is the most logical one. It's in theory the easiest one. I mean, there's nothing easy about the hoops I've got to go through. But, you know, it's for me, it's that first step on the path of justice, because if we can get the inquest reopened and we can, you know, shine a spotlight on lots of the things that are wrong with the official narrative, I'm hoping, you know, other family members will join me in perhaps future action. But also, you know, it's going to wake up a lot more people who, you know, until it becomes in court or until it's in the papers, they just don't want to go there. They don't want to believe it.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit about your efforts to get this into the courtroom. And I understand there were some further developments this weekend.
Ever since I started thinking about what I could do in trying to get to the truth, reopening my brother's inquest was a logical thing to at least see what steps could be taken. And about a year and a few months ago, I got in contact with Michael Meacher, the late Michael Meacher, the MP in the UK. And he was assisting me in just finding out, kind of behind the scenes, speaking to another MP who's actually the ex-Attorney General in the UK. That's the person that I need to submit the application to before it goes to the High Court. And he basically, you know, ascertained that I've got good grounds to reopen the inquest. And basically on the back of that basis, I've been putting together, not an application, but the groundwork that needs to be done for that. But the most important thing for me was actually to get hold of a barrister, QC, who would actually represent me in putting the application forward to the Attorney General. I was kind of unsuccessful for 3 or 4 months trying to get hold of certain chambers in the UK that would take any interest in it. But all of a sudden it was early December or late November, there was a bit of interest from a couple of chambers, which is encouraging in itself. All I gave them was a sort of skeleton argument and a covering letter. But that gave them enough to think that actually there is some merit in trying to reopen the inquest. And there are, you know, sufficient grounds on paper anyway, to look at it further. And then, you know, a month later, started doing some crowdfunding. It's not cheap. These guys aren't cheap lawyers. I'm sure you know that in the States.
Yes, I've shopped for lawyers a few times myself, and never been able to buy one.
when you calculate how much per minute, it's like, oh my God, no niceties. Let's just get on with it.
It doesn't seem fair because, you know, people are always contacting me by email or whatever, asking for me to do free work for them. And yet, if you go to a lawyer, time that they spend is going to end up, you know, at hundreds of dollars an hour, if not more than that.
Yeah, it's expensive. But so, I mean, I was quite surprised. I mean, we raised the money fairly quickly, and, you know, firmed up the meeting. And I had that on the 24th of February, just last week. It was a kind of, there's about sort of 60, 70 pages of stuff for the guy to go through, but we also had a 3.5 hour meeting. And I mean, without going into too much details, I mean, essentially, we will be submitting an application later on this year. I need to raise a little bit more money in order to do that. It's just, as you know, these things cost money, and it's going to take probably longer than I'm hoping it would do. But the plan is to submit an application to the Attorney General this year, the focus is basically going to be on inaccurate / fraudulent official reports, insufficiency of inquiry, and the discovery of new facts and evidence, which all comes under something called Section 13(1)(b) of the Coroner's Act 1988. And essentially what we have to do is put forward an application to the Attorney General to show grounds that the inquest, in the interest of justice, a new inquest should be open. And he then submits that application up to the High Court if he agrees. The High Court, you know, 99 times out of 100 will agree, and it will then get passed on to the appropriate either coroner, or in probably a case this high profile, I'm guessing it probably would be a judge, possibly, you know, some sort of senior, possibly retired judge. I don't know who would oversee it, but you know, we've got to get past the Attorney General first of all. So the focus right now is putting together the application.
Interesting. Yeah. And is there any way to know if this Attorney General is conceivably sympathetic? I know here in the U.S., there's a lot of jurisdiction shopping that goes on. I've discussed this with William Pepper, the guy who got that verdict indicting the CIA, FBI, and U.S. military for murdering Dr. Martin Luther King. He actually won a court verdict to that effect. And so he's a pretty good lawyer. And he's operated in Europe, too. And he says this jurisdiction shopping is really important, that it's often, if you have the wrong jurisdiction, no matter how strong your case is, you'll never get past the obstacles. So is there any, do you have any sense that this would be an honest jurisdiction?
Well, there's, I mean, in terms of jurisdiction, there's only one, and it's the UK. We're out of the US. So I only have one means, and that is to apply to an individual called the Attorney General. Who, I mean, happens to be an MP, but he's an Attorney General. I think he's an MP, I can't remember. So that there's only one person I can apply to. I mean, the advice I've been given is essentially the more you focus on process and those key points from the Coroner's Act, the greater, the, you know, if there's weight and merit to the claim, then the greater the chance that it's going to be you know, pushed up to the High Court. If it whiffs of anything political, then it's, I wouldn't say unlikely, but, you know, you're making it harder for you. I need to make it so easy for the Attorney General that there's no way can he possibly turn down the application. And if he does, then, you know, it's clear that there's something not quite right with his decision making. You know, so my understanding is that, you know, it should be a fairly straightforward process. Unfortunately, I mean, I was trying to apply something called Article 2 of the European Human Rights, sort of right to life, which would have expanded the inquest into a public inquiry, which has a wider scope. But for the various reasons, I won't be able to do this. So it will just be an inquest. But, you know, it doesn't matter. Even though it has a limited scope, I'm challenging things on the initial inquest, which are, you know, it's basically a narrative conclusion. So there's a lot we can attack, both through acid absence of evidence, but also just things that aren't right. I mean, the other thing that's key in this country is, you know, there's supposed to be an inquiry. You know, the barrister I spoke with basically said that, you know, by all accounts, when he looked through the material, the actual transcript and stuff of the inquest, you know, it was, and it's not to say anything bad about the coroner, you know, because nothing was really challenged. You know, she's just been given a bunch of reports from various places, from the Met Police, from the counterterrorism command, I think it's SO15, they're called. And, you know, she's just relied on what they provided and sort of rubber stamped it, basically. There doesn't seem to have been a lot of inquiry. And they've just taken everything that the Americans have said pretty much at face value in the official report. So, you know, that's an angle that we will be tackling as well.
Interesting. And I imagine that, you know, it would be a little bit difficult to really actually get anything new from American officials who were involved in this. Like if we had a case here in the U.S., we could subpoena people. And that's, of course, the reason that they made it impossible to do that. The federal courts in the U.S. are incredibly corrupt. There's something called the Federalist Society that's apparently partly responsible for that. But in your case, so if you show that these official reports or stories are inadequate, what's the remedy? Would the court somehow have a way of demanding better information from the U.S.?
I'm sure there's channels they can use. I mean, it's potentially very awkward for the British authorities. But, you know, what's likely to happen is it will be admitted in court that there is no evidence. And, you know, whether I or the legal system in the UK can obtain it, I know I can't, but, you know, whether they can or not, I don't know. I'm still keeping channels open with my communication with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. A chap today is putting forward my request to get information from his American counterparts as what I'm requesting. I've sort of set out what I'm asking from them. And, so he's working on certain aspects. But, I mean, I know they're not going to give it. They're not going to give the information, yeah? Because people have been asking for it, including myself as a family member, for years, more than a decade in some cases, some of the information we're requesting. I don't know what remedy the courts are going to have. I mean, I would like to think that if we get to a point where, you know, obviously the narrative conclusion has changed in the inquest, and the absence of evidence is acknowledged, you know, at that point, I would hope that a 9/11 commission would be formed in the UK and it effectively becomes a public inquiry. And, you know, and they use whatever channels they can to try and, investigate, but also just get this fundamental evidence. And for me, it's key. Now, I mean, I don't know whether they were, you know, this is the alleged hijackers, whether they were patsies, whether they existed, whether it was on training runs, whatever. But, you know, for me, that's the start of the official story. And if they can't produce the evidence to support that, then the official case collapses from the outset. There is no, you know, the myth is a complete myth of the 19 hijackers if the American authorities can't provide that. And in particular, if that's something that the UK authorities and the legal system can't actually obtain from the US. You know, it's everything's bullshit, yeah?
Right. Well, that's Elias Davidson's point. He says that in this case, absence of evidence is actually evidence of absence. It's not just that they're not providing backing for their story, but the fact that the kind of backing would be so obvious, so easily available, and so blatantly and obviously required to be provided, that is this evidence against these 19 guys, the fact that it wasn't provided and that never has been provided, even the fact that it wasn't provided in a timely manner in 2001 is prima facie evidence that this evidence doesn't exist, that there were no hijackers on the plane. So that's the argument he makes, and it makes a certain amount of sense to me, and it's a good angle to take. How about the BBC foreknowledge of Building 7? That's something that actually could be investigated inside the UK directly if there were a way to force people from the BBC, like Jane Stanley, for example, to testify in court about what happened that morning. Because clearly somebody who had foreknowledge, ultimately someone who was involved in this mass murder, passed information about the impending destruction of Building 7, which was then reported too early, to the BBC. Is there any way that could be part of an inquest, or a commission, if you get one?
Certainly, if it was the commission, I'd be very surprised if it wasn't. But I mean, in terms of the scope of the inquest, it doesn't really play a part. I mean, that's not to stop anyone else, going after the BBC. I mean, in actual fact, something I found out about the inquest is almost anyone can reopen an inquest. It's typically done by family members or someone related to the deceased. But, in theory, if you can put forward things, like I said, under that section 13(1)(b) of the Coroner's Act, if you can put things forward and show that it's in the interest of justice, then, you know, almost anyone can reopen an inquest. And in terms of action against the BBC, well, I mean, I guess you could bring about some sort of civil suit against the BBC. But, I mean, for me, it's not... I find Building 7, like I said before when we spoke to Kevin, that I find it interesting to try and wake people up, that coupled with Operation Northwoods. But in terms of it being directly involved with my brother's death, even though it's indirectly kind of part of it, I don't really focus on it that much. Which odd, given it was the main topic of Incontrovertible, the Tony Rook film. But like I said, it's a really good tool for getting people to wake up. I've not really explored what we could do on the legal side, and I don't, you know, it's expensive doing legal action, and, you know, I need to be absolutely sure that it could actually lead somewhere for justice for my brother. And I'm not convinced, certainly for the inquest anyway, it's a direction we should be taking. Mm. I have put it to the barrister, and he's going to get back to me on that, but, you know, it's not been my primary focus.
Right. Well, you'd have to wonder whether there might be employment records and state, you know, records at the BBC that would indicate who was in a position to get this kind of information. You know, you would think that a report that Seven had come down would have to come from some credible source. They wouldn't just report that out of nowhere or on a rumor. And so, theoretically, if you were able to get the whole chain of command in the BBC newsroom that day, and, you know, get their organizational chart, theoretically, you could find the right people to question. And that's true for other areas, too, of course, the military, NORAD, and the Moroccan embassy. I actually tried to figure out who was there at the U.S. embassy in Rabat, Morocco, when Walid Eshari supposedly walked in and said, well, here I am. You know, you said I was on that plane that hit the tower, but I wasn't. And yes, that's my picture in the paper. And yes, this guy is my brother that you're saying was also on the plane, but I had nothing to do with it. And so I went over to Morocco and contacted the embassy, but they claim that they all rotate out. So there was a whole new staff there. And I guess a FOIA request could maybe conceivably get you who was there at the embassy in fall of 2001. I don't know. But those are the sorts of things I think of when, you know, it comes to court action. You know, who are the people that you need to drag in there and force to testify under oath, and then ideally grant them immunity from prosecution in return for important, truthful testimony? That's how normal criminal cases work. And
it's a peculiar situation. I mean, the inquest, it's actually, the application is on paper. So it's a weird situation. You're almost petitioning. I think I call it petitioning. You're petitioning the Attorney General. So you don't have the ability to call witnesses, and you can't, there's nothing you can obtain. You can obviously indicate that you would like to hear sworn testimony from XYZ, but that's not actually what is probably going to persuade the Attorney General to reopen the inquest. As I said, inquests are kind of got a limited scope, and they are different to, you know, I guess, a regular court case. But that's not to say that it can't be very useful in this case. But going back to the BBC, I mean, I recall the chap who was behind the conspiracy files when he did a follow-up. I mean, he showed an email, didn't he, which people have looked at, and it said basically the information came from Reuters. So, I mean, first of all, I do agree that, you know, the BBC should have been questioned. But, you know, the information they've said comes from Reuters. I did actually write to the editor, I can't remember the chap's name, of Reuters, because, I mean, I used to work for, my brother used to work for Reuters, and I used to work for a company that was owned by Reuters. And they kind of every year send a card to both my parents and to Caroline, Jess' fiance. And I just wrote back to them sort of saying, you know, there's a lot of controversy around this, and the BBC have said that the early report of the tower collapsing, Workplace Centre 7 collapsing, came from Reuters. And although they're Thomson Reuters now, I mean, the guy basically said, you know, I'll go and have a look at it. And he got back to me and basically said that the guy who put out the report, this is from Reuters, still works for them, but he can't recall where the report was called in from. So, I mean, you can find out, I guess, as far back, but, you know, like you say, you really want these people in court to, you know, to be questioned under oath.
Right.
You know, but I mean, going back with the early reports of World Trade Center 7 collapsing, I mean, I think it started as early as 11:15, didn't it? With some,
yes, I think CNN, you know, was actually ahead of BBC.
It's incredibly early. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, with that initial report from Reuters, I don't have any idea of time frame. You know, I guess you'd need to really go all the way back up the chain to the source and where that came from.
Right. Yes, that's tricky. It's the same situation, actually, with the reports of the alleged hijacker still being alive. And the BBC also reported that. And then later they claimed that their source was Sharq Al-Awsat, the Arabic language newspaper out of London, owned by the Saudis. And it's been hard, you know, it's hard to tell whether the various reports about this all came from Sharq Al-Awsat and who their source was. It's tough to track this stuff down at this date, but there's just so much, you know, there's so many loose threads here. You know, if you pull on enough loose threads, theoretically, you ought to get something on the other end.
Well, I hope so. Like I said, you know, I mean, the inquest to me, it's a stepping stone. It's key for me to get this back into court. And I know there's a whole bunch of stuff that will be exposed on, you know, in terms of the absence of evidence and stuff. And, you know, that's important to do because I feel that, you know, I mean, I know out of the 67 British victims, there's two other victim family members who, you know, believe like I do that the official story is a lie. And, you know, I'm hoping that number grows and then we become a pain for, you know, the UK authorities.
Well, God willing, that's precisely what will continue to happen. And I appreciate the hard work that you've put into this so far, Matt Campbell, to get justice for your brother Jeff and to bring peace and justice to this whole planet, because this is such an important case. The reverberations are still driving the war and injustice of today. Okay, well, great. I look forward to touching base with you as this case develops. Keep up the great work. God bless.
Cheers, Kevin. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Best-known critics of the war on terror is joining us tonight, inshallah, for the next 3 weeks live on Radio Islam International from the United States of America. Dr. Bell, good evening to you, sir. Thank you for your time.
Well, good evening. It's good to be back with you.
You too, sir. Thanks so much. Dr. Bennett, with regards, let's start talking about Syria. What is happening in Syria? You know, we see peace talks going on, but no actual peace taking place.
Yes, it's a tragic situation, and I think we have to remember how the situation was created. This is part of a long-term geostrategic plan, primarily by and for the benefit of the State of Israel. Oded Yanon was the geostrategist who wrote in the 1970s that Israel would need to find a way to break up the countries around it into smaller pieces and balkanize them along ethnic and sectarian lines so as to make Israel secure and able to continue to expand. And that's precisely what has happened. The Israelis orchestrated the September 11th attacks in the United States as a coup d'etat to put the U.S. and the West at perpetual war with the enemies of Israel, that is, the Islamic world, and specifically to bring the U.S. into these wars in the Middle East to destroy the states that they saw as enemies, beginning with Iraq, moving on to Sudan, which has been broken into two pieces, Libya, and Syria. So Syria has been destabilized primarily by the Zionists. That's what is going on there. And all these other stories that are being promulgated in the Zionist-dominated mainstream media are simply red herrings.
Dr. Gavin, somebody asked me, so maybe you can answer this question. Did are we closer to World War III than ever, or is it started and we don't even know?
That's a really interesting question. Some neoconservatives have told us that World War III is the war on Islam, and that war has been ongoing for some time, and everyone understood this after September 11th. That's the neoconservative party line. But in reality, the situation is a bit more complex. And if by World War III we mean a nuclear exchange and something comparable in destructiveness to World Wars I and II, I wouldn't say that it has begun yet. But we are very much in danger of that happening because of Russia and the United States having been brought into this very, very tense situation in Syria.
Dr. Gavin, taking the discussion further, let's talk a little regarding the elections in the United States. United States presidential elections, is the likelihood of a Trump victory looking more and more likely by the day?
Well, yes. I think the Republican establishment, which is skeptical of Trump, which I believe fears Trump, is becoming more and more desperate as they try to figure out a way to stop him. Now, it does seem a little odd that the Republican establishment, which is largely dominated by the neoconservatives, who are primarily interested in serving as appendages of the Likud party in Israel, at least in terms of their international policy, would be so worried about Trump, who is, of course, the most boisterously Islamophobic candidate of the lot. But I think that they simply don't trust him. And there's also an internationalist agenda, I believe, that ties in with this kind of Zionist isn't even really the right word for it, because this is a group of people who are part of an elite that is dedicated to taking over the world with usury as their number one weapon, and military power simply backing that up. And so these people are internationalists. Trump is a nationalist, and he's interested in what's best for the U.S. interest. And that could put him into conflict with these internationalists and Zionists, of course. And so they don't trust him. They're not sure what he would do if he were in power. And they're becoming very, very desperate, because whatever Trump says, his popularity just keeps steady or even increases.
Dr. Gavin, Trump might be wrong most of the time, but even a broken clock is right twice a day. Was he right on taking on Jeb Bush on his brother's role in 9/11?
Yes, he certainly was. That was a smart political move, as we've seen, because Jeb Bush, the favorite candidate before the process started, has been forced to withdraw. And I thought it was very interesting the way that events unraveled, or the way the Jeb campaign unraveled during the past 10 days. First, we had Trump accelerating his attacks on the Bush family for its role in 9/11 and the 9/11 wars. It seemed like each day, or every few days, Trump would say something more extreme, culminating with his saying that if you elect me, you'll find out who really knocked down the Twin Towers. And so when Jeb Bush then reacted by bringing his brother, George W. Bush, into the campaign with him, they finally appeared together. And then virtually the next day, Jeb announced that he was shutting down his campaign. So, yes, I think Trump knocked Jeb Bush out of the race by highlighting the Bush family's complicity in 9/11, and I think that was great. But on the other hand, Trump has not been willing to deal with the neoconservative Zionist element of 9/11, which is by far the biggest element. That was the major force behind 9/11, and even Trump can't say that. He is forced to utter platitudes about how much he loves Israel and how much he will support Israel, how he will fight the enemies of Israel, starting with Iran. And this is apparently mandatory. You can't even run for president in this country and have a slight hope of success if you don't make these obsequious platitudes towards Israel.
Yeah. One more question, Dr. Gavin, with regards to Obama making or announcing the long-awaited Guantanamo Bay closing plan. But the proposal dugs the question where of that facility would be and whether he can complete the unlikely closure before he leaves office. Dr. Gavin?
Well, there was a wonderful satire published recently. I think it was Andy Borowitz, which was a fake news story that Obama has moved Congress to Guantanamo. And, of course, the point of that was that Congress dominated by Republicans and neoconservative funded people is against closing Guantanamo, whereas Obama has stated that he wants to close Guantanamo. He's been saying that ever since he ran for president in 2007, the first time. So will this be part of his legacy? Will he be able to fulfill his campaign promise to close Guantanamo? And of course, the problem is that even though we have serious doubts about 9/11 and these other big atrocities that have driven the war on terror and the attendant Islamophobia, it still seems that that Islamophobia is stuck permanently in the deep mind, perhaps one could say the reptile brain, of the American public. So politically, closing Guantanamo is a difficult move for Obama because the neoconservatives and their minions, including people like Trump, will bash him and say Obama's a Democrat and the Democrats are soft on Islamic terrorism. They're turning loose these horrible terrorists who attacked us on September 11th and will probably come back and attack us again. And they'll use this for political gain. So Obama might hurt his party if he closes Guantanamo. And again, I can't emphasize too strongly how critical it is for every Muslim in the world to commit to putting their money, their energy, their intelligence and creativity on the line and working to expose the 9/11 inside job. If we don't do this, the genocide against Islam will not only continue, it will accelerate.
Yes, important point to mention that towards the end, Dr. Kevin Better. Thanks so much for the inputs, much, much appreciated. And we look forward to talking to you next week, same time, Dr. Barrett.
Okay, likewise. See you next
week.
Have
a lovely week, sir.
Inshallah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, welcome back to this special edition of Truth Jihad Radio. We've heard Matt Campbell. We've heard my interview with Radio Islam International. And now we're going to spend the last 15 minutes talking about the recent presidential elections news with Rolf Lindgren. Rolf Lindgren was my campaign manager back in 2008 when I ran for Congress, and he's got a long history of activism with the Libertarian Party. He's an expert on James Madison, Galileo, and various and sundry other things. So, hey, how's it going, Rolf?
Hey, it's going really good. We got a wild election brewing.
It's crazy, man. What's going on?
My predictions on your show the last time I was on turned out to be wrong, though. But
yeah, you were calling Martin O'Malley as a shoe-in for the White House. Martin knows somebody. Right?
Yeah, he didn't make it. I guess he didn't make it. So
no, I don't think so. Yeah. Well, who could have predicted this craziness?
Well, nobody seems to have predicted it. I didn't think Trump was going to make it, but now I think Trump is set. I mean, basically, if you look at what's happened so far, I mean, it looks like Trump is going to win the nomination, and then I would have to take him over Clinton in the head to head.
Now let's talk a little bit about that. I just had Dr. Bob Rochlein on the show. He's a big Hillary fan, and you know he thinks Hillary is going to be the next president. I cited some articles I've seen that say that Trump actually would have a big advantage against Hillary due to all of her scandals that he can, you know, play up like a reality TV host.
I agree. I mean, I'm not saying that Hillary couldn't win it. I mean, I think it could go either way, but I think that Trump would have the advantage with all the scandals. Now, the thing they're going to try to use on Trump is, you know, this crap about David Duke. But you know what? I think most people, when it's all said and done, they're going to be so sick of hearing this stuff about David Duke that's completely irrelevant. I mean, people are just sick of hearing about that stuff, and that's, you know, that may be one of the reasons why Trump is already doing so well, because people are just sick of that kind of stuff, you know?
I'm sick of it. You know, that guilt by association crap, they've used that against me. Like, oh, I was on the same radio show as, like, you know, as somebody like David Duke was on years ago, and so therefore I must be exactly the same as David Duke.
I know, it's just complete idiocy, and, you know, I don't think people are that stupid. I think someone, it might influence a few people who don't really know what's going on, but once you've heard, I mean, this is going to be rehashed over and over again for months once the two nominees are set, and by the time the election is here, people are going to know that the David Duke thing is complete crap. First of all, he didn't even endorse him anyway, and it's just complete idiocy. The endorsement doesn't help Trump's campaign. It hurts his campaign. I mean, anybody with a half a brain knows that it doesn't help your campaign to have David Duke endorse you. So,
and, you know, frankly, Rolf, I find a lot of David Duke's recent stuff actually less obnoxious than a whole lot of what gets put out as pablum in the mainstream. I mean, he's been doing some really acerbic, hardcore, accurate analyses of Zionism. He clobbered Alex Jones in their debate. Frankly, I don't think David Duke is nearly as evil as, you know, Paul Wolfowitz, well, Richard Pearl, all those guys.
Well, I don't think he is either, but like I said, he's got unfortunately, he's been tagged with this case. I mean, he hasn't even been in the KKK since the 1960s, as far as I can tell. But yeah, I mean, the stuff he says, I haven't heard much from him. I did see some video that he just put out because of this big controversy, but he doesn't sound and if it wasn't David Duke doing the talking, you wouldn't think much of it at all. You just think, hey, this is another guy that critiques, you know, foreign policy and stuff. I mean, it isn't really all that exciting, frankly. It has,
well, his
has
debate with Alex
do.
Was. Did you see? You didn't see his debate with Alex Jones?
I did not see that.
Oh, you got to see that. It's great. Yeah, David Duke wipes the floor with Alex Jones.
Oh, well. Well, it sounds interesting. I did not catch that. But I think that Trump has the advantage because he doesn't have the baggage, the scandals. And the other thing is most people have heard of Trump for 30 years or more. I mean, I remember hearing about Marla Maples or something back in the 80s. Don't you remember that? Marla Maples? I mean, I'm not even sure why I heard about it, but it seemed like it's one of those things that everybody seems to have heard about. And
not me.
I think she was the one. I think Trump had an affair or something with Ivana Trump. Remember Ivana Trump and all that? But I'm just saying, is it negative attacks don't work as well against well-known people? Now Trump has proven to be a lot smarter than we thought. You know, a lot of people thought it was going to be a publicity stunt or something, I just didn't think he was going to last. But obviously he has, now that they've done all this voting. And Mitt Romney just came out attacking Trump. Did you hear about that this morning?
Yeah, and a lot of people are speculating that there could be a third party run where the traditional Republicans, led by the neocons, would take over a third party, like the Constitution Party, and deny the presidency to Trump. At least that's what they're saying. I don't know if that would work.
Well, there is a way to do that, and actually I think it is a possibility. I think that I look at it from like the one world government or the new world order perspective. And like I said, the new world order people still have Hillary Clinton. So if they think that she can win the election, then they don't have to resort to any of this third party stuff. But the candidate that's set for a third party run would be Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
And Bloomberg, if you read what he's described as in the news media, he's described as a fiscal conservative and socially moderate. And if he ran emphasized that, then that would siphon votes from Trump, and then could in theory throw the election to Clinton. So that, to me, the Bloomberg option is the one option that's out there for the new world order people, as I call them. You can call them the establishment or whatever you want to call them. And those people who the people who are these billionaire type people who are in charge, they one of the things they don't want is they want the debt ceiling raised, and they want the government budget raised, and they want all the government debt paid on time. Okay, that's probably their number one priority. And with a guy like Trump or even Cruz, you know, what if President Trump tells the Congress, oh, by the way, I'm not going to raise the debt ceiling anymore, or, oh, I'm not going to sign another budget if you keep raising it. So don't raise the spending this time. You know, what if Trump does that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that would be
a disaster. He also wants to audit the Fed. He supported Rand Paul's bill to audit the Fed.
Auditing the Fed there's a lot of things that Trump has said that I completely disagree with.
Same here.
But we don't, like I said, now that Rand Paul is not running, it's kind of like the lesser of two evils kind of a situation. And I think that Trump, you know, Trump has said some things that are interesting. Like he says he doesn't want to take sides in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. He says that if I'm going to negotiate, I can't take sides from the beginning. And some, you know, Marco Rubio says that's an anti-Israel position, but I, you know, if that's what his position is, that's a good position. So, you know,
And isn't it interesting that he can just hammer and clobber all of these traditional Republicans who are falling all over themselves to sell themselves to Israel and to Netanyahu, and here Trump doesn't seem to give a rat's patootie about that, and he gets all the votes. I mean, it looks like maybe these, you know, Zionist media brainwashers are losing their grip on the public mind.
They could be. What one of the things that's happening is that the U.S. economy is no longer expanding, and we're actually in a situation now where the next generation doesn't expect to have it as well as their parents. It's actually, they're expecting worse than their parents. That's never happened in American history before, and that's if the people who are running the ship are causing that to happen, then that's when they're going to lose power. Actually, historically, that's when regimes lose power. So Trump could be a manifestation of the fact that the United States is no longer expanding economically or in any other way. It's the government is expanding, but not the individual freedom and the prosperity of the people. And that could be a manifestation of whether Trump can fix any of it. You know, that's a big question, but I know for sure that Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio aren't going to fix anything. So I'm ready to roll the dice with Trump and see at this point what happens. Or I'd take Cruz too over Rubio. Rubio, I think, is completely out of it. I don't see any. By the way, did you hear the big news from Fox News today?
No.
Roger Ailes just pulled the plug on Rubio and said that the hosts of the shows now can take shots at Rubio if they want, because he's given up on Rubio. So,
well, I don't blame him. You know, I don't know if you saw my piece citing Wayne Madsen about how Rubio used to be dancing in this Miami version of the Village People, this like flagrantly gay dance troupe, and he was the guy with the cocaine at the orgies. he apparently was not exactly a family values guy in his youth, and he may not be. And according to Madsen, he's basically owned by the Meyer Lansky mob.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but he started out as a Tea Party candidate at the same time that Rand Paul was elected, but they've moved in separate directions since they were elected to the Senate. And, you know, Rubio has a bad voting record when he shows up to vote. He's voted for all kinds of big got like the TPP, and he pushed that immigration bill, that gigantic bill that you know nobody read, of course, and he's got a bad voting record on a lot of things, and you know he made a few good votes here and there, probably because he was running for president, but now Rubio is going to be used up because he's not even in the Senate. You know, he gave up his Senate seat, you know. He's not running for re-election to the Senate, so now he's worthless. He's completely worthless as of next January because he's not even going to be in the government anymore. Rand Paul, at least, is going back and is going to retake his Senate seat. He's considered a safe bet to be back in the Senate, so at least Rand Paul will be in the Senate looking out for our interests.
Rand Paul is the only one other than maybe Bernie Sanders that I can stand. But, you know, getting back to Bloomberg, I had Robert David Steele on the show not too long ago. He's a former CIA officer who says part of his job description was doing false flags, and he's a whistleblower today. He's represented in this new book on the Paris false flag, another French false flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. He's got a great piece in there about false flags, how to recognize them. And anyway, he thinks that a Bloomberg candidacy or even a presidency would be great. He thinks Bloomberg is an honest guy. And Steele says that we really need to totally reform our election system. We need hand-counted paper ballots. We need the end of winner-take-all. We need all of these reforms to get third parties into the picture. Basically, we need to democratize the system. And, of course, we need to get big money out of the system. And until we do that, it's useless. So he thinks, you know, he was hoping Sanders would buy into some of this program, and he didn't. So now he's hoping that Bloomberg will.
Bloomberg is bad news. I wouldn't go anywhere near Bloomberg.
Okay, why is that?
He's in the same crowd as all the people who are who hold the government debt, the Goldman Sachs, the Bank of America type people. He's a Mitt Romney type guy. I mean, these guys, these are the guys who are basically for big government wars, nothing ever being changed. They don't want the Fed audited. They want the government, you know, the national debt raised whenever they need to. Bloomberg is just is look. You look at the contributors to these people, and you can see the same people who don't the same the groups that donate to both parties. You have to focus on the groups that donate to both parties. Okay, not the Koch brothers because they only donate to Republicans now, but you got to look at the Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley. Look at those donors. They donate to people like Clinton, Obama, Bloomberg.
Well, wait a second. This is what Steele was saying, that Bloomberg, it takes an independently wealthy guy, like massively independently wealthy, backed by more multi-billionaires. That's the only way we're going to get changes, to have someone like that decide to lead the charge to overturn this corrupt system that we have today. Right, as you rightly point out, Rolf, both major parties are bought and paid for. So we need, if we don't get rid of that system, we're screwed.
Well, Trump. Well, yeah, but what's the solution to the system?
The solution is total public financing. Absolute public financing. No private financing whatsoever.
Then the government is
funding. or a limit of $5 campaign contributions.
You know what happens when the government finances elections? And they decide who gets the money. And
no, you got to have transparent
rules. We had a law
rules.
That the Green Party and the Libertarian Party didn't get any of the money for some reason. They somehow made the rules rigged, so that they didn't get any of the money.
Well, that's what we have to overthrow that system, and
that's
what
the problem with
Steele is saying, that we need
the government
like
funding the elections is not an improvement over what we have now. It makes it actually worse.
Well, no. See, as long as the system is set up to be absolutely transparent, then having quote unquote the government running it or a foundation, it doesn't really matter, is what you need. What you need is transparency. The same thing with the money system. We need to make the money system 100% absolutely transparent, no secrecy whatsoever. And to do that, it has to be considered a public utility.
Okay, there's a root of the problem that's deeper than the money, though, that most people miss. And it doesn't really apply to the presidential election, but it applies to pretty much everything else. The size of districts are too big. Okay, if you look at what the founding fathers wanted, they didn't want any districts over 30,000 people.
At good point. If you don't have
big districts, you don't need big money to win.
That's right. Democracy really can only function in relatively smaller units, and our units are way too big. I'm with you on that. Rolf Lindgren, well, we're at the end already. This has been a good, short, but sweet interview, and I do hope to have you back for more extensive analysis before too long.
Okay, that sounds good. Thanks, Coven.
All right. Take care, Rolf.
All right, bye.
Bye.